You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, got big plans for the new year? Maybe you're ready to finally launch a small business, start a blog, or promote your favorite passion project. Well, in this day and age, it doesn't exist if it doesn't have a good-looking professional web presence. Luckily, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a unique website. Showcase your work, publish content, even sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from the look and feel to settings and products using beautiful templates created by world-class designers. And there's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code KICK to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, that's squarespace.com and offer code KICK for 10% off. And now, enjoy the podcast. Namaste. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. If you're a stodgy curmudgeon like me, when you hear that word namaste, you probably think of dope-smoking hippies in a VW van or rich, bored Orange County housewives in designer yoga pants. I am by nature skeptical of anything that might be described as alternative, holistic, or new age, up to and including the practice of meditation. But over the course of doing this podcast for the past 3 years, time and again, a number of guests in the scientific and medical fields, I'm talking about real medicine, not shaman or crystal healers, actual doctors and experts have extolled the myriad virtues and benefits of meditation. Arianna Huffington suggested it as an excellent natural sleep aid. Dr. Daniel Amen discussed meditation's power to improve brain plasticity. And Nobel Prize winner Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn shared research proving that it actually grows and repairs human telomeres, promoting longevity. And then came Dan Harris, the co-host of ABC's Nightline and the weekend edition of Good Morning America, who reached out to me a half a year ago, preaching the joys of meditation. But it wasn't until recently when he published a sequel to his number one bestseller, 10% Happier, titled Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, that I said, hey, that sounds like me. All right, let's finally see what this is all about. So today, Dan Harris comes on the podcast to share his own journey from meditation skeptic to self-professed meditation evangelist and how he vastly improved his work, his creativity, and his home life. He discusses the actual science behind the many physical, mental, and emotional health benefits of meditation, dispels some common myths about the practice, and provides a crash course in how you can start meditating with as little as 1 minute a day. Plus, he tells stories from the 23-state bus tour he went on with a man he calls his meditation MacGyver, including encounters with some surprising meditation fans, like an Ohio congressman, formerly incarcerated youths, and even the cadets and professors of VMI. Coming up with my meditation guru, Dan Harris, in just a moment. Dan Harris is the co-anchor of ABC's Nightline and the weekend editions of Good Morning America. He's the author of 10% Happier, a number one New York Times bestseller. And then he launched the 10% Happier podcast and the 10% Happier app. Now he's followed up his bestseller with a new book called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, a 10% Happier how-to book. Dan Harris, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's so cool to be here after having listened so many times.
Well, thank you.
Face to face.
Before we even get into the new book, I just want to ask about the first book. Why 10%? Why not 100% happiness?
Because anybody who promises you 100% happiness is full of shit. I mean, this is not doable. You know, what I was trying to do was to counter-program against the over-promising of the self-help industry. Mm-hmm. You know, these people tell you you can get anything you want through the power of positive thinking. That's just not going to happen. And I like the idea of telling the truth. And for me, I started to meditate and I found that it was very useful for me, but it didn't solve all of my problems. I'm not as tall as I would like to be. Yeah, there's certain places on my head I'd like to have more hair. Meditation didn't fix that.
Yeah.
However, it made me less yanked around by my emotions, more focused, more productive, easier to live with, and that compounds over time.
Yeah, and I can tell just by the title, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, that this book is geared toward me and people like me because, you know, I'm from Texas. My dad literally says P.F. Chang's is too new age for him. And I don't think he really knows what the term means. But, you know, I don't have a guru. I don't have a mantra. When I hear someone say namaste, it's like fingers on a chalkboard.
Yes.
And I don't even know what it means. Do you know what does namaste really mean?
I think it means I bow to the light in you. I think that's what it means.
Okay.
So a little new. You can kind of hear a pan flute as I say it.
Yeah.
You're my type of person.
Yeah.
You're who I'm talking to.
Okay. And clearly I'm not alone in my skepticism. In fact, you say that before you had this life-changing event that we'll get to in a minute, you were somewhat skeptical. What was your view of meditation?
Yeah, I thought it was for people who live in a yurt and are really into aromatherapy and Cat Stevens and maybe like take pictures of themselves on the top of Himalayan mountains wearing loincloth. You know, just not – it was – to me, it seemed utterly ridiculous to the extent I even thought about meditation. But what changed my mind was the science. Mm-hmm. There is a significant amount of science that strongly suggests that meditation can lower your blood pressure, boost your immune system, literally rewire key parts of your brain associated with self-awareness and with compassion and stress, and that it's very good for two things that I've wrestled with my whole life, anxiety and depression. And so when I saw the science, and by the way, my parents are scientists. My wife, who you just met, is a scientist. And so for me, that carried a lot of weight. And then I also learned that meditation does not involve a lot of the things that I had feared it might. Like, you don't have to sit in a funny position. You don't have to join a group. You don't need a guru. You don't need special outfits. It is very simple, secular exercise for your brain.
I think for me, the thing that has kind of made me curious about this is I've had several podcast guests who were scientists, like you were saying, who have said it has all these health benefits. In fact, the Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, even said it lengthens your telomeres and extends your longevity. Walk us through some of those health benefits.
Yeah, so I want to say from the outset that the science around meditation at times gets hyped. And I don't want to fall into that. But let me just – having said that, there is a lot of exciting science. And the high-quality stuff – there's some low quality science, but the high quality stuff points. I think we haven't reached a stage where it's definitive, but it strongly suggests that there are lots of benefits. So let me give you just one study that I really like from Harvard in 2011, I believe. They took people who had never meditated before and they scanned their brains just to get a baseline read. And then they had them do 8 weeks of short daily doses of meditation. And then at the end of those 8 weeks, they scanned their brains again to see what happened. And they found that in the area of the brain associated with self-awareness and compassion, the gray matter literally grew.
Wow.
And in the area of the brain associated with stress, the gray matter literally shrank. So in effect, you're performing neurosurgery on yourself. You are rewiring your brain in really healthy ways. And it's also true.
That's incredible.
It's also true for the areas of the brain associated with attention regulation. So focus, which is a huge problem these days. We're just under assault by tweets and status updates and texts, et cetera, et cetera. And it's also true for an interconnected region of the brain known as the default mode network. These are the parts of the brain that fire when we are in our default mode, by which I mean what happens when you aren't focused on something and you just revert to your default mode. You're thinking about yourself. You're thinking about the past. You're thinking about the future. You're ruminating. Most of it's negative. It's repetitive. It's self-referential.
Trump tweets, huh? Basically. Do you think meditating would help Donald Trump? If anyone needs it, I imagine he does.
I think meditation would help anybody. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. And, you know, as I often have said, if Donald Trump is interested in meditation, he can call or tweet me at any hour. I will hop on the phone and talk him through it.
Yeah. Any follow-up so far?
Zero. But the first time I made the offer was just a few days ago publicly. So we'll see. Maybe he'll listen.
Okay. Maybe you can bring it up to him at the fake news media awards.
We'll see. I'm not sure I'm an honoree. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing.
Are you hoping to be? Are you campaigning this year?
I have no view. Whatever happens, happens.
Well, a moment ago, you alluded to the event that precipitated your journey toward meditation, an infamous on-air breakdown you had in 2004. What happened there?
I had a panic attack on national television on Good Morning America, a little show we do at ABC News. Because I'm a masochist, I actually asked our research department to find out how many people were watching, and they came back with a number of 5.019 million.
Now, is that including YouTube?
No. YouTube has way surpassed that. You can look it up on YouTube. If you just put into YouTube the search terms panic attack on national television, boom, you'll get it, which is great. So this panic attack happened. My job that morning was the news reader, the person who comes on at the top of each hour and delivers the headlines.
Right.
Actually, they don't really have these on the morning shows anymore, but they used to.
This was a
common position.
Yeah.
And I was filling in for Robin Roberts. That was her job at the time. And I had done the job many times before, and I had no reason to foresee what was about to happen, which was terrible. A few seconds into my shtick, I was, you know, reading six stories off of the teleprompter. So six voiceovers, six quick stories where we would roll video over my face as I read. And I just lost – I couldn't breathe. My heart was racing. My mouth dried up. My palms were sweating. My lungs seized up. I couldn't talk. And I had to kind of squeak out, back to you, to the anchors. And it was horrible. And even more horrible, or I would say even more embarrassing, is the backstory of what caused the panic attack. Which was that I had spent a lot of time as a young, ambitious, idealistic reporter in war zones after 9/11. Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, Israel, the West Bank, Gaza. And I came home from those experiences and I got depressed, but I didn't know I was depressed.
Really?
I was exhibiting what I now know to be some of the signs and symptoms. I was having trouble getting out of bed. I felt like I had a fever all the time. My body knew I was depressed, but my mind did not. And or my conscious mind did not. And I did a very dumb thing, which is I started to self-medicate with recreational drugs, including cocaine and ecstasy. And even though, you know, I didn't party that hard. It's not. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Wolf of Wall Street where they're pounding Quaaludes. No, that was not me. But I went to a doctor after the panic attack, and he pointed out that, you know, even though my drug use was pretty intermittent and never when I was on the air, it was enough to artificially raise the level of adrenaline in my brain and prime me to have this panic attack.
Okay. And so then how did you arrive at meditation? Did someone suggest it to you? Did you have a vision of the Buddha or what? How did this start?
It was just a quick trip to P.F. Chang's, actually. Yeah. That's what did it for me. I love that line from your dad. I love your orange chicken.
That'll do it. Oh, it's all that MSG.
So it didn't happen quickly. After the panic attack, I started to see a shrink. I decided to quit doing drugs, and I saw a shrink once or twice a week for a long time, and he really helped me quit drugs. But the meditation was not on my list, not even like 16 or 17. I wasn't on my radar at all. What happened was I was assigned by my boss at the time, Peter Jennings, who's no longer with us, but was an iconic, sort of American icon, even though he's Canadian. He assigned me to cover faith and spirituality for ABC News, even though I am an agnostic. I was raised in the People's Republic of Massachusetts by a pair of atheist scientists. And I, as I like to say, I did have a bar mitzvah, but only for the money. So I was not spiritually inclined, but Peter really forced me into this job. And through that, I ended up stumbling upon some new agey self-help type writers. And most of what I encountered among the self-helpers was complete bullshit. But there was a guy named Eckhart Tolle, who's a very famous self-help writer, a New Age guru. And his in one of his books, he talks about the fact that we have a voice in our heads. And he's not talking about schizophrenia.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
He's not talking about hearing voices.
Okay,
he's talking about your inner narrator, the voice that chases you out of bed in the morning and is yammering at you all day long, has you constantly wanting stuff, planning stuff, not wanting stuff, judging people, comparing yourself to people, judging yourself, blah, 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 all the time.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, Sam Harris, who's also a well-known podcaster, has he has joked that when he thinks about the voice in his head, he feels like he's been hijacked by the most boring person alive who says the same shit over and over. And when you're unaware of this nonstop conversation, it owns you.
Mm-hmm.
When you're unaware that you have this thought machine inside you offering you terrible ideas all the time, that's when you eat when you're not hungry, mm-hmm. or you check your voicemail or your email in the middle of a conversation with your kid, or you lose your temper when it doesn't make any sense. And what meditation does is systematically wake you up to this inner chaos so that it doesn't own you.
And what you practice is something called mindful meditation. Mindful medication was what you did before.
Well,
now it's mindful meditation.
Yeah, yeah. You know, mindful self-meditation.
Okay. Now, what is mindful meditation?
I like mindful meditation because it is, while it is derived from Buddhist meditation, it is thoroughly secular, is also very, very simple. So I'll just walk you through the beginning steps. The first step, there are only three steps. I could teach you in fewer letters than it takes to send a tweet. It's that easy. Well, it's not easy, but it is simple. So the first step is to find a reasonably quiet place, close your eyes, sit comfortably. The second step is to just focus your full attention on the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. Usually you just pick a spot where it's most prominent, your nose, your chest, or your belly. So this sounds very, very simple, but you'll notice quickly that you get distracted. Like as soon as you try to focus on the simple thing of your breath, your mind's going to go like, whoa, what's for lunch? Why did I say that dumb thing to the boss? Why? Where do gerbils run wild? Why did Dances with Wolves beat Goodfellas for Best Picture in 1991? Blah, blah, blah. The whole game, and this is the third step, the most important part, the whole game is just to notice when you've become distracted and to start again and again and again and again. And that is the bicep curl for your brain that shows up on the brain scans. This is how you change your brain. People think that they have failed. I talk about this a lot in the book. People think they have failed when they notice they've become distracted, but that is the victory. And it is a victory of major consequence. Because when you see how crazy you are, that crazy can no longer have so much purchase over your actions. And that is what we're doing in meditation. We're not floating off into the cosmos. It's not a bubble bath. You don't have to reach bulletproof imperturbability. All you have to do is try to focus on one thing at a time. And when you get distracted, start again and again and again.
Okay. So when you're focusing, do you want your mind to be totally blank or no?
No. Well, I like to say to people, this whole idea of clearing your mind is the most pernicious myth that is, I think, stopping so many people who otherwise would meditate from meditating. You will clear your mind in one of two ways. One, if you become enlightened, or two, when you die. Clearing your mind is impossible. You can, however, focus your mind. So if you're feeling, if literally all of your attentional bandwidth is feeling your breath on the in-breath and on the out-breath, that is a focusing exercise. It won't last very long because the mind is a thought machine. We evolved on the savanna for threat detection. We were looking for lions who were going to come eat us and our babies. So we have a very healthy kind of hypervigilance in our mind. I think, however, we get too good at it and we feed it through technology. And what meditation does is hack the evolutionary process so that you can get better at focusing.
My girlfriend likes to say that I practice mindless meditation because I'm really, really good at spacing out and daydreaming. She'll say something about Paul Ryan in the news or something. And then 10 minutes later, she asked me what I'm thinking about. And then I have to explain how this crazy 6 degrees of separation led me from Paul Ryan to thinking about, I don't know, some restaurant that I had a really good Philly steak in years ago and wondering if that restaurant's still there or something like that.
That's completely normal. That is completely normal. What I would say is that we all, distractibility is totally normal, especially in our tech-drenched age. Mm-hmm. What meditation is good at is cutting down on the sort of really negative parts of that, where you feel like it hurts your productivity, mm-hmm. where you feel like it may hurt your relationships because you're not tuning in for people. It can really be good for that.
I read that you find it useful to give names to your distractions.
Yes.
Introduce us to a few of your distractions.
Well, let me just say, so I wrote this book with a guy named Jeff Warren, who's one of my favorite mm-hmm. meditation teachers. He's a really funny, smart guy. So he had this idea that I thought was really goofy, which was, you will notice over time that there are usually 5 or 6 recurring types of distraction. And his point was, one way to reduce your kind of hostility towards what distracts you is to give playful names to your various inner neurotic programs. So for me, anger is a big one. I had an angry grandfather named Robert Johnson, who was quite an unpleasant chap, although later in his life he became quite nice. But he was not nice for much of his life. And so I notice anger coming up a lot for me, which I think of as my inheritance from Robert Johnson. And actually just giving it this playful little name of, oh, here's Robert Johnson. Welcome to the party, buddy. Can disarm and defang him so uh-huh. that I'm not
that makes sense.
Fighting with it so much. And that when Robert Johnson comes across my mental windshield when I'm not meditating, say if I'm having a conversation with my wife that's unpleasant or whatever, I can notice, oh, I'm about to get angry. I'm going to say something that's going to ruin the next 48 hours of my life. I can let it pass.
Helps you identify.
That's how useful it is.
Do any people know that you've named a distraction after them?
So one of my distractions is from pop culture. We all have a sort of inner logistician that's just thinking about how we're going to get everything done that we need to get done. I call that voice Julie, the cruise director from the Love from the Love Boat. I'm a very ambitious guy, really type A ambitious, and so I have when that voice fires up, I call it Sammy from the famous great novel What Makes Sammy Run, about an ambitious Hollywood executive. What else do I have? Arthur, who is my inner author, like when I'm writing. I write books, and so I'm constantly sort of in meditation, and then something interesting will happen in meditation. I'll be like, oh, I could write about this, and I'll be like, oh, that's Arthur.
Now, we mentioned your co-author, Jeff Warren. You call him your meditation MacGyver. Tell us a little bit more about him.
He is a really dynamic meditation teacher from Toronto who happens to have struggled with ADD his entire adult life.
Oh.
And what was beautiful to watch over the course of working on this book with him is he sort of came into his own and realized that his mental challenges, which, by the way, aren't his fault, mm-hmm. actually make him a better teacher because he's much better at connecting with people, which goes to the question you asked me. Meditation MacGyver, he loves locking in on a person, finding out what's stopping you from meditating, or if you are meditating, what are your problems in meditation, and using every tool in the toolbox to help you get over the hump. And so we structured this book as a road trip where Jeff and I went across the country, 18 states in 11 days, which I don't recommend doing, in a big, silly rock and roll tour bus that had been previously occupied by the members of Parliament Funkadelic. And what we did was we went out and met groups of people who want to meditate but aren't, and we helped them get over the hump. So we spent time with cops, social workers, celebrities, politicians, military cadets, all sorts of people. And Jeff would just dive in, hear people's issues. He worked out with my wife, for example, who wasn't meditating, and it was really successful at getting a large percentage of these people into an abiding meditation habit.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Dan Harris when we come back in just a minute. If you enjoyed my interview on Monday with Daniel Ellsberg, the whistleblower behind the famous Pentagon Papers, then you've got to go see The Post. From one of the most acclaimed filmmakers of all time, Steven Spielberg, and two of the best actors of their generation, Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, comes a movie that top critics are already raving about. The Post is Time Magazine's number one movie of the year. featuring an acclaimed cast that includes Sarah Paulson, Matthew Rhys, Bob Odenkirk, Alison Brie, Tracy Letts, and Bradley Whitford. This thrilling drama is smart and suspenseful and deals with a subject matter that is incredibly timely for our country. Hear the untold story of the greatest government cover-up in U.S. history and the journalists who risked everything to expose the truth. Don't miss The Post, now playing. Support for today's show comes from Squarespace. Ready to start your new business? It's a new year, so why wait to set your plans in action? The future is coming. Make it brighter with Squarespace. Folks, you know as well as I do, everything is online these days. And if you don't have a solid web presence, you don't exist. You really don't. You could be the greatest in the world at what you do, but no one will ever know. So before you do anything else with your new project, your first order of business should be getting a stylish professional website. With beautiful templates created by world-class designers, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website. Showcase your work, blog, or publish content, even sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from the look and feel to settings and products, and it's all optimized for mobile right out of the box. You can use Squarespace's analytics to help you grow in real time, and there's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. But if you do have a question, Squarespace's award-winning 24/7 customer support is there to help. A dream is just a great idea that doesn't have a website yet. Make it a reality with Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code KICK to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com, offer code KICK. And now, back to the show. You said that you went and met with cadets and professors at Virginia Military Institute on this tour, and you did meditation classes with some of the professors who had already adopted some of these practices. Did VMI get much flack for this?
So VMI, actually, they were really nervous. They almost canceled our visit right before we came because they had this thing where, I guess a year or so before our visit, they had an anti-stress day on campus, and they handed out coloring books to people, and their alums and the cadets from a rival school called the Citadel started mocking them openly. And they were worried that if they brought meditation to campus in the form of me and Jeff and our tour bus, that they would get further mockery. However, given that there is a lot of science that suggests meditation is really good for you, and given that there are all these aspirational figures in elite athletics, in the corporations, in science, and frankly, in the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Army, both of which are spending tens of millions of dollars to research whether meditation can make more effective troops and more resilient troops, they allowed us to come, and we spent time with some professors and with some cadets. These were like some archetypal badass cadets, men and women, and the cadets themselves had no compunction about meditating. They're like, look, in fact, one of them was the captain of the football team. And he was like, yeah, this just makes me better at my game. Another guy was on his way to the special forces. He was like, this just makes me smarter and more focused. What's the big deal?
Yeah, and that's interesting that you said that the military is actually spending money on researching this now, because that would make sense. I mean, if soldiers or special forces guys in Afghanistan were more focused and not so easily distracted, not so edgy, then they probably do their job better and risk fewer lives, I imagine.
That's exactly right. So two reasons to do it with the troops. One is, it's actually a counterinsurgency tactic, if you think about it. What do insurgents try to do? And I've spent a lot of time on patrol with our troops. They try to bait our troops into killing people unnecessarily, which turns the population against them.
Yeah.
If you're less emotionally reactive, you're going to do less of that, at least theoretically. So that is one big reason to teach the troops. Another is, if you are more resilient, if you're able to sort of surf your own emotions without getting drowned in them, that can help us deal with the scourge of PTSD, which has really been a huge problem for the military.
You also met with formerly incarcerated youths who apparently they were already using similar techniques. They just weren't calling it meditation. What were they doing?
That was right here in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
A group called Inside Out Writers, which was started by screenwriters who teach kids in juvie hall or prison, and then kids who've been released from juvie hall or prison, how to write as a way to deal with their feelings. And many of these kids, actually, by the folks we met with were a little bit older, they've been out for a few years, said that they had actually started meditating in prison because it was something that had given them like a dose of sanity.
Huh. I mean, in fairness, you have a lot of time to meditate.
You do.
Prison,
you do. And yeah. a lot of them would do it when yeah. the lights went out at night so nobody else could see them.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Wow. Yeah, he also talked with Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio, who apparently is a meditation evangelist himself and even wrote a book of his own on the subject. Has he had much luck spreading the word among his colleagues in the House?
Short answer is no.
Yeah.
Slightly longer answer is Tim Ryan is, I believe, one of the most effective public spokespeople for meditation because mm-hmm. he embodies sort of a variety of all-American normalcy. He's a giant former quarterback, backslapping politician from the Rust Belt in Ohio. He just kind of looks the part of an all-American beer-drinking guy. And he can talk about the benefits of meditation in a way that, you know, is very far from P.F. Chang's, right? Like he's really down to earth. However, so he's had a lot of luck as a voice in the culture for meditation. Not much luck getting his fellow members of Congress to do it. And I would like to see him have more success.
Yeah. Representative Tim Ryan apparently sees meditation as a social justice issue, which I found interesting. In other words, for him, you know, rich white housewives shouldn't be the only people to have time and money to go on a meditation retreat. Did he have any ideas on how you could spread a meditation to the people who are lower income and probably have more stressors, the people who probably most need meditation?
I was so struck when he said that. I'm glad you honed in on that because I think he's right. I think he's absolutely right. A couple of years ago, Time magazine did a cover story on what they call the mindfulness revolution, the meditation revolution. And they had this beautiful white woman on the cover meditating. And I was happy that they covered meditation, but I was a little unhappy that they had a beautiful white woman on there. I'm married to a beautiful white woman. I have no problem with. I'm not trying to be anti-white
woman. But it's like a desperate housewife thing in a lot of people's minds.
Well, it gives the image that meditation is only for rich white people who live on the coast and go to Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not against that because I am those things, right? I'm a white person who lives on the coast and I shop at Whole Foods. But meditation was invented by people in the Indian subcontinent millennia ago and has been practiced by every major religion in every part of the world for millennia. It is for everyone. Anybody who has a mind can benefit from meditation. And we're seeing it being used on foster care, on children in foster care, and children in juvie hall, public schools across the country. I have three wonderful friends who are teaching it in the toughest schools in inner city Baltimore. It's for everyone. And I do think it's a social justice issue. Now that we know this stuff works, it should be taught in public schools. And we get taught the state capitals. We should be taught our own inner landscape so that we can navigate our emotional squalls more in a more sophisticated manner.
And you touched on something there that I wanted to ask you about, the religious aspect. A lot of people probably associate it with Buddhism and think, I can't be a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim and practice meditation. Is there any truth to that?
Look, there's no question. You shouldn't hide the ball that meditation is derived. Mm-hmm. Mindfulness meditation, which is secular, is derived from Buddhism. However, you know, I believe – and somebody will correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I believe that it was the Arabs and Muslims in Baghdad way back when who first described algebra. That doesn't mean that we can't do algebra. It's a universal phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Buddhists happened to describe mindfulness, sort of our ability to be aware of our emotions without being yanked around by it, mm-hmm. beautifully. But that doesn't mean it only belongs to the Buddhists. It's a universal human capacity. We are classified as a species, as Homo sapiens sapiens, the one who thinks and knows he or she thinks. But that second sapiens has atrophied over time because nobody bothers to point out to us that we have this capacity in our mind to be aware of what's happening in our head without being yanked around by it. And so I do believe that this should be taught in schools. This should be available to everyone. And while it is historically accurate to say it has some religious connections to Buddhism, I don't think it's actually accurate if you look at the way the practice is taught. But by the way, just, you know, the three steps I taught you earlier about how to meditate.
Yeah.
Did you hear any metaphysical claims as a part of that? There aren't. Yeah. So I think it's if you're teaching that to kids, I am entirely comfortable.
Now, when you encounter skeptics, what is the single biggest reason they give for their resistance? Is it that or Time?
Time. Really? Time is the biggest issue, because I actually think, notwithstanding your skepticism and the widespread skepticism about meditation in the culture, really what we've seen in the culture in recent years, from what I can tell, is meditation has lost some of the veneer of New Age weirdness, and actually has become aspirational. When you got people like, you know, Novak Djokovic and the Chicago Cubs and 50 Cent and Lena Dunham and Katy Perry, when you've got people like that meditating, it becomes more of an aspirational thing. And I think now where we've moved is that people say, yeah, I know I should do this thing, but I don't have time.
Yeah.
And so my answer to that is that I have good news. And I have even better news. So the good news is, I think 5 to 10 minutes a day is a great meditation habit. I've spent a lot of time talking
really,
to
neuroscientists. Really, that little?
Absolutely. I've spent a lot of time talking to neuroscientists who study meditation. And we don't know exactly what the minimum you can do is and derive all of the advertised benefits. But 5 to 10 minutes, I can see there's a reasonable consensus that actually that is a great meditation habit. If you think 5 to 10 minutes is too much, I think 1 minute counts. And it doesn't even
really
have to be every day. I say 1 minute daily-ish is enough. What are we trying to do in meditation? We're trying to wake you up from the autopilot of this sort of fog of rumination and projection in which most of us live our lives, and we're yanked around by this kind of subconscious conversation we're having with ourselves. 1 minute is enough time to sit down, notice how distractible you are, and then in the rest of your life, when you're ambushed by some big emotion, you have a better chance of not being owned by it. There is an incalculable difference. This is, again, my friend Sam Harris. There's an incalculable difference between how much damage you can do in an hour of anger versus 2 minutes of anger. If you can pull yourself out of the spiral in 2 minutes and make an apology, how much less anger can you do than if you're caught for an hour?
Now, you say you do 2 hours, right?
I do.
2 hours a day.
Yes.
How do you find that time?
I admit it sheepishly, because I feel like I'm always trying to inhabit the mind of a skeptic. And if I'm a skeptic, I'm thinking, oh, this dude does 2 hours. I'm never going to do that. Therefore, I don't have to meditate. The fact that I do 2 hours has nothing to do with how much a beginner needs to
do. Yeah, it's a choice.
I am really fascinated by what meditation can do for you. Mm-hmm. And when you realize that happiness, that all of the qualities we want, happiness, peace of mind, focus, gratitude, compassion, these qualities are not factory settings that you can't change. They are skills that you can develop. When you realize that to me is the animating insight of my whole, you know, evangelical side hustle. When you realize that, and when you truly experience it as I have, you start to wonder, okay, well, if you can become 10% happier, what's the ceiling? And so for me, I really have a desire to go deeper. And so, and I think that's to the benefit of the people to whom I'm speaking through my podcast, app, books, whatever. You want the guy who's talking to you about meditation to have done quite a bit of it. Mm-hmm. Just like you want your trainer to have done a triathlon or two. That doesn't mean you have to do it. By the way, I'm not a meditative triathlete, just so you know. I'm an aspiring one.
Now, I always assumed that there was just kind of one type of meditation, but you and Jeff come up with a number of different meditation practices for all kinds of different goals. What are some of the goals and results that folks can target their meditation toward?
Since way back in the day, the Buddha was teaching two forms of meditation in tandem. Mm-hmm. One was this mindfulness meditation that I described earlier. That is the kind of meditation that has gotten most of the PR in recent years. Mm-hmm. However, there's a kind of meditation that really has gotten ignored in the process, but is just as important, and it's called compassion meditation.
We could all use that.
Absolutely.
These days.
Now, the bad news is what I'm about to describe to you sounds irretrievably annoying, and frankly, it is a little, but just bear with me.
Okay.
So compassion meditation is or it's sometimes called loving kindness meditation, which again is even more deeply annoying, but basically the goal is to sit eyes closed and you envision people. You start with yourself, then you start with somebody you really love, and then you start with a benefactor, somebody who's like done a lot of things for you. Then maybe you go to a neutral person and then a difficult person and then all people. And you systematically send good vibes in the form of phrases that you repeat to yourself, like, may you be happy, may you be safe, et cetera, et cetera. It sounds like Valentine's Day with a knife to your throat. It's like really, really, really annoying. However, there's now a big body of science that suggests that this kind of meditation not only has health benefits, like lowering your blood pressure, making you calmer and happier, but also that it changes behavior.
Huh.
kids.
Makes you a nicer guy.
Yes, preschoolers who were taught compassion meditation were more likely to give their stickers away to kids they didn't know. I have a preschooler at home. That's a big deal. And there's an enormous amount of science that suggests that people who are kinder are happier, healthier, more popular, and more successful. In my first book, I wrote a whole chapter called The Self-Interested Case for Not Being a Dick. And I think it's really true. And so Jeff and I wanted to make sure that we put a lot of emphasis on this kind of meditation because it has profound effects.
Yeah, and that type of meditation sounds like the great antidote to all the meanness and tribalism that seems to exist in this country right now.
Yes.
Wow.
Absolutely.
You said that you even have a creativity meditation that you used when writing this book if you ever had a writer's block. How did that work?
So I, as a writer, and I not only write books, but I write TV stories, and they're my stories. It's such a painful process. Writing is so, for me, I've heard people say that they love writing, and I don't understand them. For me, it's torture. And it's just like these seemingly insoluble problems are just coming up all the time. How am I going to explain this? How does the story unfold in this way? How do I? And you're just kind of constantly on this racking pain of trying to figure these things out. What I noticed through writing this book, I finally started to follow my own advice, was that when I would bump up against one of these big problems, instead of trying to bulldoze my way through it, I would step back, maybe sit for a few minutes, and sometimes, not always, but sometimes the answer would emerge, because there's a significant amount of research that shows that when you're trying to work on something creatively, the move is to work, study, think about it, and then drop it. And then often the answer will come when you take a shower.
That's when the aha moment comes.
In Mad Men, they ask Don Draper, when somebody asks Don Draper, how do you come up with your slogans? He says, like, I think about it all day, then I go to the movies. And then it comes.
And, of course, there's the last episode.
That's where he's meditating, right?
That's where he came up with the Coke spot.
Yes, exactly.
Have you found that your home life and your work life, your family life have made you more tolerable and made things more enjoyable for everyone?
Absolutely. Although if she were here, she would give you her 90% still a moron shtick. So, perfection is not on offer. I retain the capacity to be a dummy in lots of ways. But I am more patient, more present, more focused, more. So we had a big infertility struggle and finally we're able to have a child. And it's just this incredible thing to have this little being around the house. And what meditation has helped me do is really wring all the joy out of it, or more joy than I otherwise would have, without getting distracted and thinking about what's the next thing.
Yeah.
And so all of that adds up to a much more congenial home life. Does that mean I never snap? No, we were a little late this morning, or I thought we were going to be a little late, and I snapped a little bit at her. But I find that I do that less frequently, and I'm quicker to apologize.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty good endorsement, and she seems to like you pretty much from what I've seen this morning, so I think it's working.
Some days.
Well, here it is, the new year, and maybe people want to start off with a New Year's resolution to start meditating or meditating more, but it's so hard to keep New Year's resolutions. Before we go, what is the trick to sticking with meditation?
Okay, so the reason why resolutions are – I had to learn a lot about habit formation and human behavior change in order to write this book. There's a reason why keeping resolutions or forming any healthy habit is hard, because evolution did not bequeath us a mind that is good at that. Evolution bequeathed us a mind that is good at threat detection, looking for saber-toothed tigers, or finding food and mates. Why? Because evolution didn't care about a long-term health. It only cared about getting your genes into the next generation, your DNA into the next generation. So just know, as you try to do this, that it is hard. Just knowing that it is hard for all humans, not just you. You aren't uniquely messed up. It is hard for everybody because that is the way the mind works. That is the first thing to know, and that is a big leg up, because the spirit with which you want to approach any new habit is one of experimentation. You got to be willing to try, fail, start again. Without try, fail, write it off. Because you just need to figure out what are the ways that is going to work for you. For example, people think willpower is a thing. Willpower is a thing, I guess, but it evaporates quickly, especially when we're tired or hungry or lonely or bored. So best not to count on willpower. Best when you're looking for a healthy habit to look for the benefits and to let the benefits pull you forward. So my example, my advice for somebody looking to start meditation would be to say, promise yourself you're going to do 3 or 4 weeks of 1 minute most days.
Okay.
So one minute daily-ish. And by the end of that month, notice, have you become a little bit more focused? Have you become a little bit less quick to anger? And then if you fall off and you start to see, oh, that stuff is coming back for me, well, there you go.
Okay.
Then the incentive becomes clear. And the thing about one-minute meditations is sometimes you reach the end of the minute and you're like, oh, I'm already here. Maybe I'll do more. And then you switch from extrinsic motivation, in other words, doing it because you think you have to intrinsic motivation. Mm-hmm. And that truly can change the game.
Okay, well, I'm going to give it a try. And just for the record, P.F. Chang's, there's nothing wrong with it.
No.
Salt and pepper shrimp, we love.
Love it.
Okay. Well, again, Dan Harris's book is called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, a 10% Happier How-To Book. And you can get his 10% Happier app and subscribe to his 10% Happier podcast on iTunes or wherever you download your apps and podcasts. Dan, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. So much fun.
Thanks again to Dan Harris for coming on the podcast. You can order his book, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, on Amazon or download the audiobook on Audible. Get Dan's 10% Happier podcast and app on iTunes. Follow him on Twitter at Dan B. Harris and catch him weeknights on ABC's Nightline and on the weekend when he co-hosts Good Morning America. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.